Hello, and welcome to the RTGP podcast on syncope. Today I will be talking to Dr. Leslie Cavey, GP and RTGP clinical champion for syncope. She's also chair of the charity POTS UK. Thank you very much for speaking to us today, Leslie. Can you tell me why you developed an interest in syncope?
Well, I was doing some voluntary work for a syncope-related charity, and I became aware of the significant disability that was incurred by people with recurrent syncope, even vasovagal syncope, and its huge impact on their quality of life. I also became aware that misdiagnosis in syncope and epilepsy is very common. Up to a third of adults and children are on long-term anticonvulsants for epilepsy, but don't actually have epilepsy. In fact, many have syncope, both vasovagal and occasionally cardiac syncope. Convulsive limb movements are very common in syncope, and that in combination with non-specific changes on EEG can lead to people being mistakenly diagnosed as having epilepsy.
I think that's a really important point. We sometimes see it on discharge summaries. They come with a diagnosis of a fit, and you wonder how much it actually was a fit and whether it was just a faint with a bit of jerking. So if we go back to basic principles, how would you define syncope and how is it different to a blackout?
Well, it's probably easier to start by defining a blackout. A blackout is a term mostly used in the UK, in fact, and elsewhere. It tends to be referred to as transient loss of consciousness, or TLOC, T-L-O-C for short. There is rapid onset of loss of consciousness associated with loss of postural tone. Episodes are of short duration and they're spontaneous and complete recovery. So epilepsy and hypoglycemia are both types of blackout. The word syncope comes from a Greek word meaning cutting off. Syncope is also a subgroup of blackouts specifically caused by reduced cerebral perfusion and is the most common type of blackout.
That makes sense. So a patient might present to us saying that they've had a blackout, and it's up to us as to whether we think that syncope is the diagnosis that explains the symptom of blackout. So as a GP, you've got a patient who presents to you with a blackout and you're thinking that the cause might be syncope. And then obviously there are other differential diagnoses. How would you approach this patient from first principles?
Well, Tony, as with most conditions in medicine, a detailed history is the key to a diagnosis. The RCGP Syncope Toolkit has a syncope checklist to aid assessment of patients who present with suspected syncope. You would want to ask about the circumstances of the event. Was there a trigger such as exercise, or in older people, perhaps a heavy meal, alcohol, or a bout of coughing? Were there any symptoms immediately preceding the blackout, such as lightheadedness, sweating, chest pain, or palpitations? Now, what was the posture of the patient? Had they been standing for a while? Were they a bit dehydrated? A witness account can be very helpful. Ask them what the patient looked like before, during, and after the episode. Were their eyes closed? Were they cyanosed? A family history of heart disease or sudden death at a young age can be important. And the patient's past medical history might point to other conditions like orthostatic hypertension. Physical examination may well include a cardiovascular and a neurological assessment. It should also include a lying and standing blood pressure in older children and adults. And of course, all patients with an unexplained blackout should have an ECG. That's NICE guidance. And finally, the age of the patient may help point to some conditions which tend to occur more commonly in certain age groups.
Thank you. That's a really useful run through of the things that we should be doing in primary care. So if we start with the younger age group, with children and teenagers, how common is syncope and what are the underlying conditions that are most common?
Well, it's estimated that up to 20% of children will experience a faint at least once before the end of adolescence. In general, the causes of syncope can be divided into four groups. First of all, we have vasovagal syncope. It's also known as neurally mediated syncope, and it's by far the most common type of syncope in both young and older people. The second group is orthostatic hypertension, which is less common in the young, but can occur, for example, in Addison's disease, rare types of autonomic neuropathies, and is more commonly found in chronic fatigue syndrome and the hypermobile form of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. The third group is cardiac syncope, the type of syncope that carries the worst prognosis. Cardiac conditions that cause syncope in children include inherited channelopathies, such as the long and the less common short QT syndromes and Brugada syndrome, Wolff-Parkinson-White, cardiomyopathies, catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, or CPVT for short, congenital coronary artery anomalies, and valvular stenosis. The fourth category is others and includes rarer conditions in children like pulmonary embolism, pulmonary hypertension, and in teenagers, POTS is common but is commonly misdiagnosed. Finally, psychogenic pseudosyncope, or PPS for short, is not technically syncope, but it looks like syncope. As previously mentioned, vasovagal syncope is by far the most common cause of syncope, and cardiac syncope is rare, affecting around 2% of children who attend hospital with syncope. Therefore, it's probably even less common in the community setting. However, it is worry about a child possibly having cardiac syncope that understandably generates much anxiety in their parents.
Yes, that's often the case, that we worry about the rare, but that actually common things are common. And I should say, for anyone who wants to know a bit more about psychogenic pseudosyncope, the screencast, which is part of this course, is particularly dedicated to a bit of an explanation of that. So we've talked about sort of teenagers and children, but what about very young children and infants? Do they get syncope?
Yes, in fact, vasovagal syncope is the most common cause of syncope in younger children too. In toddlers, it's sometimes known as reflex anoxic seizures, but the use of the term seizures is confusing as it's not a type of epilepsy. Right. In response to an unpleasant stimulus, such as falling over or having a toy taken, excessive vagal tone causes a period of asystolic vasovagal syncope. The child will fall to the ground, stop breathing, and is usually a deathly pale colour. Due to cerebral anoxia, seizure-like jerking or twitching limb activity often occurs in vasovagal syncope, as was discussed earlier. Reflex anoxic seizures are distinct from cyanotic or blue breath-holding attacks, which occur during or following a prolonged bout of crying.
So I can well believe that as a parent, having a child do that would be absolutely terrifying, and it would be probably easy to focus on limb twitching and come in saying my child's had a fit. As a doctor, as a GP, how would you manage a child with reflex anoxic seizures?
Well, although the diagnosis may be very apparent from the history, it's important to arrange an ECG to ensure there's not a cardiac cause, as some rarer channelopathies, such as long QT syndrome, can also present with cardiac syncope following a fright, such as a sudden noise like an alarm clock, and this needs to be excluded. GPs are not usually skilled at reading ECGs in small children, and therefore referral is often indicated. However, management is largely conservative, with children inevitably recovering from the reflex anoxic seizure, and pacemakers are only very, very rarely indicated where episodes are extremely frequent and traumatic.
That's good to know that the causes are not usually sinister. You're absolutely right. I certainly wouldn't be trying to read an ECG on a child. I find it difficult enough in adults. Coming away from the less serious causes and back to the serious ones, the rarer things that we really don't want to miss, what would make you suspect cardiac syncope?
Well, a family history of inherited cardiac disease or a sudden unexplained death in someone under the age of 40 would be very concerning. This sudden unexplained death could be a drowning accident or an unexplained car crash, where the cause of syncope may have been an undiagnosed arrhythmia in a relative. Also, syncope during exercise may be cardiac in origin, whereas syncope after exercise is mostly vasovagal in origin. Other pointers to cardiac causes include a personal history of heart disease, chest pain or palpitations prior to syncope, syncope when sitting or lying down, and syncope with little prodrome or warning. Also, an abnormal ECG should trigger an urgent referral to secondary care.
That's really useful, and I think it emphasises the importance of taking the open history at the start, but then drilling down with a few closed questions into things like, when did exactly the syncope happen? If it was around the time of exercise, was it during or after? Now, you mentioned earlier POTS, which is the abbreviation for postural tachycardia syndrome, as a cause of syncope in younger people. And I know this is a particular interest of yours. Can you tell us a bit more about this condition?
Well, POTS is a more recently recognised condition and is most common in younger women, but it can occur in older children and in adults too. It appears to be four times more common in women than men, and we're not really sure why. Patients with POTS lose the capacity to regulate blood flow to many organs, including the brain, the heart and the gut. It isn't always associated with syncope, and you certainly don't need to faint to obtain a diagnosis of POTS.
So what symptoms that might present to me as a GP should make me think of POTS? Because I suspect it's one of the conditions that the first challenge is getting us to think about it.
Yeah, the commonest symptoms of POTS are recurrent lightheadedness, fatigue, and fast palpitations. But affected patients can experience symptoms in almost every system. For example, nausea and other GI disturbances, cognitive slowing, chest pain, and breathlessness. As symptoms can occur every time a patient is upright, it can be very disabling.
Yes, I can imagine that would interfere with your life quite significantly. So if I am suspecting it because of these symptoms, how am I going to go about making a diagnosis or at least backing up my suspicion to start thinking about a referral?
Well, the key is really having a high index of suspicion. I often find POTS in women with medically unexplained symptoms. They often have multiple symptoms, have seen a lot of specialists, and yet have no clear diagnosis. It's associated with chronic fatigue syndrome, and of course some people do faint. Interestingly, some people with long COVID seem to have developed POTS. It can be diagnosed with a 10-minute stand test, although if there's doubt about the diagnosis, referral for tilt table testing may be necessary.
And is the 10-minute stand test something we can do in general practice? How would I go about doing it?
Yes, we can do it in general practice, although I usually bring my patient back for a second appointment, which is a little bit longer. You need to rest the patient for a few minutes until settled, and then record their heart rate and blood pressure. Then you stand them up and continue recording every 2 minutes. You should stand the patient for a minimum of 3 minutes to record orthostatic hypotension and 10 minutes if you're looking for POTS. I tend to stand the patient against a wall or in front of a chair in case they faint. In order to have POTS, the patient must experience symptoms of POTS and demonstrate a sustained increase in heart rate of 30 beats per minute or more.
So if I do that test, if I suspect POTS from the presentation and I do a stand test and the patient's heart rate does go up and they do get the symptoms, then what? Am I going to treat them in primary care only, or what, should they be referred on to a cardiologist or to someone else?
Well, yes, in fact, you can treat them in primary care. The initial treatment is very similar to that of vasovagal syncope and orthostatic hypertension. We recommend around 3 litres of fluid per day in an adult, or until the urine runs a pale straw colour in children. It's really important to boost the fluids in the early morning or even before rising, as symptoms are often worst in the morning. Extra salt is usually recommended unless contraindicated. Compression tights or sports clothing and a graduated exercise programme can be helpful. We usually recommend starting at a very low level of exercise undertaken in the supine position, for example, Pilates, recumbent exercise, biking or rowing, and swimming. There are postural manoeuvres that can prevent syncope or pre-syncope in all three conditions. Patients can be taught to clench their buttocks and thigh muscles, cross their legs tightly together, rock up and down on their toes, or even fold their arms tightly. Activating skeletal muscle helps to raise the blood pressure, but in an emergency, it might still be necessary to squat down or even to lie flat with your legs in the air. If these symptoms do not improve after 3 to 6 months, or if patients are especially unwell with POTS, then medication such as a low-dose beta blocker, evabradine, midodrine, or fludrocortisone can be helpful. However, as with all medicines for POTS, they're off-licence, so referral to secondary care may be necessary.
That's really useful. I suppose depending on your what you expect, the waiting time for secondary care, you might be referring whilst doing those things or waiting for those things to help and then referring. Now, earlier on, you also mentioned psychogenic pseudosyncope, which we also cover in our screencast. Is that something that can be diagnosed in primary care?
Yes, it was previously considered to be a diagnosis of exclusion, but there are some characteristics that can positively help to identify psychogenic pseudosyncope or PPS. And asking a family member to video record the event on their mobile phone can be an incredibly useful tool. Although most episodes are brief, if it lasts 15 to 30 minutes, or if several episodes occur in a single day, this would point towards PPS. Also, in both epilepsy and syncope, eyes are often open, whereas in PPS, they are usually tightly closed. Unlike vasovagal syncope, there's often no trigger and no prodrome of sweating, pallor, or nausea. However, to clarify the diagnosis, it might be helpful to refer the patient to a syncope specialist. An episode may sometimes be provoked on a tilt table with video recording. Typical features: a normal EEG, blood pressure, and heart rate recording during episodes will support a diagnosis of psychogenic pseudosyncope.
Thank you. That's a useful roundup again, another condition that I maybe don't consider often enough. So if someone listening is now intrigued and wants to learn a little bit more about syncope and the various causes of it, where can they go?
Well, the RCGP has a syncope toolkit, which can be found in the e-learning section of the website. It's open access. It contains more detail about these conditions and many others that cause syncope. It also has a quick syncope checklist, as previously mentioned, and a small ECG library. Within the e-learning section, you will also find a case history-based e-learning module and 5 minutes to change your practice. Useful documents to refer to include the NICE Blackouts Guidance and the European Society of Cardiology's Syncope Guideline, which is also open access. Also, STARS, a charity which is part of the Arrhythmia Alliance, and POTS UK have further information for both patients and healthcare professionals on their websites.
Thank you very much. That's been massively useful. And I've worked with Leslie producing some of these e-learning modules, and I have to say I've learned a huge amount about syncope. So I would encourage you to go and look at those further resources on the RCGP site. Thank you very much, Dr. Leslie Cavey, for talking to us today about syncope.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure.